well, we all have to eat.
Yeah.
We'll eat different food. That's a different curriculum. But yeah. in most countries, we all eat by putting food into our mouth. So that system is basically the same.
Yeah. De huiskoersfeer, yeah. Podden som handlar om den svenska skolan. Med Karin Berg och Jakob Mölstam. Hej och välkomna till avsnitt nummer 2 i intervjuserien av Skolsverige. Det är alltså renodlade intervjuavsnitt där vi går ifrån vårt vanliga format för att istället intervjua någon intressant person eller grupp personer som sticker ut på något särskilt sätt inom skolvärlden. Det här är vårt andra avsnitt och dagens gäst är Pedro de Bruycker som är lärare, lärarutbildare och utbildningsvetenskaplig forskare i Gent i Belgien. Och eftersom han är från Belgien så kommer den här intervjun att vara på engelska. Så om en liten stund kommer vi skjuta över till engelska och jag hoppas att ni står ut med det. Han har varit lärarutbildad sedan 2001. Han har skrivit ett antal böcker med syftet att mygga av missförstånd i samhället kopplat till dagens ungdom eller kultur eller utbildning eller så. Och en av de här böckerna är just den som handlar om att mygga av liksom myter om utbildning. Har översatts till engelska. Den har sålt ganska bra över hela världen. Och den håller nu på att släppas i Sverige. Eller snarare så har den släppts i Sverige på engelska. Men snart kommer en svensk översättning. Och med anledning av det så har vi bjudit in Pedro till Skolsverige för att ta och prata lite grann om det här med myter inom utbildningsvetenskap och lärares förhållningssätt till forskning och beprövad erfarenhet och systematisk kvalitetsutveckling och så. Mycket nöje! Pedro, you and me, first of all, welcome to School Sverige, our podcast.
Glad to have me.
Really nice to have you. You and I, we got an opportunity to talk when you visited Sweden in March and the research at conference.
Correct.
Yeah.
It was a great experience.
It was, right? I mean, I got the opportunity of listening to you when you gave a talk about this book, and it has really resonated with me, a lot of the points. What did you bring from that experience, from the conference?
Well, first of all, the conference for me is a great initiative. I've been to several around the world now, mm-hmm. and we are always complaining, both as teacher and both as researcher, that there is a big gap mm-hmm. between research and teaching.
Yeah.
And for me, I think it's impossible to make a researcher of every teacher.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't, because they want to teach.
Mm-hmm.
But I myself, I'm pretty frustrated that some very interesting stuff that we have found in research mm-hmm. doesn't find its way to the classroom.
Why is that, do you think? Why is it that it doesn't find its way?
Well, there are several reasons, and one important reason is that it's not interesting for researchers
mm-hmm.
to do this, because nowadays in quite a lot of countries it's publish or perish.
Mm-hmm.
So I still do research myself, and sometimes I'm sitting down, I'm wondering, working on a new paper that I'm writing for a journal,
mm-hmm.
and then I know that this will be read by 10 or 12 people maximum.
Yeah.
But if I want to have a bit of a career in scientific world,
mm-hmm.
those 10 or 12 readers are so important. And many institutes
mm-hmm.
nowadays only look at that kind of output.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not in the benefit of the researcher to reach an big audience.
But I was wondering, because you wrote a blog post a few years ago, but it's one of the most read on your blog, about comparing educational systems. And one thing that got me thinking at this conference, because it was teachers and researchers from all over Scandinavia, and I would say at least Northern Europe, like, how much can we actually transfer from our different countries? Like what could a Swedish teacher learn from research conducted in Belgium, for example?
That's a very good question. And the first thing when I'm discussing comparative education,
mm-hmm.
the first thing I always say, you can't compare.
Yeah.
Still, that has a lot to do with educational systems and the context.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at how people learn Then I'm not talking about curriculum. Then I'm not talking about the institutes, but I'm talking really about how the brain works or how pupils learn. Well, we all have to eat.
Yeah.
We'll eat different food. That's a different curriculum. But
yeah.
in most countries, we all eat by putting food into our mouth. So that system is basically the same.
Yeah.
And for instance, when you go into more details, then it gets much more complicated. There are big discussions about reading. And in the English world, you
yeah.
really had reading wars. About phonics, on the opposite, whole language approach, from which we know that doesn't work and phonics work better. But languages do differ.
Yeah.
And for instance, if I look to the same topic in Dutch, my native language, then we have not dissimilar words, but with different accents. This makes it interesting. For me, it's also interesting to look where the similarities are and where the differences are.
Yeah. Yeah, going back to the research at the conference, Tom Bennett, the founder, he spoke in the beginning and he was talking about teachers' research literacy. What is your view on that? Like how much can a teacher be expected to know about research?
Well, I don't think every single teacher needs to be a researcher. Because, well, they chose their job to teach and to be together with children. And while I'm really fond of research, research takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And I think that teachers don't want to spend all that time while not spending time with children. But there's a big difference between doing your research yourself and being able to understand research and have a kind of reflex that when you hear the famous phrase science says, that you say, wait a minute.
Exactly. Wait. Yeah.
I think that's pretty standard.
Yeah.
That everybody should know, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Exactly. And this is really why I like the idea of your book, because I think it does a great deal when it comes to helping teachers to get more experience of thinking about research, or I mean, at least it's a way of breaking research down and kind of serving them easy to understand bits of information on what to be critical about and what things that are maybe red flags when it comes to trends and other things within education, really.
Thank you. But for us, it was, you know what the most difficult task was in writing the book?
No, what was it?
Trying to be objective ourselves.
Yeah, of course.
Because both Casper, Paul and I have strong opinions on certain topics that are discussed in the book. We have to acknowledge that in the scientific world, this is an item of discussion. This is something that the scientific world is having big arguments about, but there is no winner. So if we would have written a book based on our opinions, we would have written Discovery Learning is a Myth. But that would be dishonest.
So that is really nice that you kind of keep yourself to that standard, even if it means not taking an opportunity that maybe you both want to do.
And sometimes I do read stuff that I really like as an idea, and that has been debunked. And then I say, oh, damn.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not in a book, but probably will end up in the sequel.
Yeah, because you're writing the sequel right now with 35 new myths, right? Yeah.
Yes, we are. We are trying.
Exactly.
We are trying.
How about we go into some of these myths in the book, and you can give kind of a short version of, like, what does research say about this to kind of get people interested in reading?
Great. Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into the, because you have 35 myths in this book, and that's really impressive. But some of these are really well discussed in the Swedish debate about the school system as well. So I thought, let's go into them, and you can give us a short version of, like, what does research really say? For example, school kills creativity, and Sir Ken Robinson, he's had a huge impact in Sweden. How is that a myth?
Well, actually, that myth wasn't included in the original book. in the Dutch book. But we were asked so many times if it was correct. So we did a fact check.
Okay.
And it's a bit more complicated than that. The first thing we did was check the research that he mentioned in his famous videos about the paperclip. And for the people who don't know the video, it's saying that if you're a genius, you know 200 applications of a paperclip. And a little child, 6-year-old, will also be able to find 200 ways of applying a paperclip, while a normal person, when you're an adult, only knows take 10, 12, 20 maximum. And so Ken Robinson says it's because of schooling and school kills creativity. Sounds great.
Yeah, it does.
And first,
and horrible.
And horrible, yeah, because we are an education and we're horrible people.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
It can be correct, but that's another story. So the first thing you do, does the test and the experiment exist? Great news, it exists. The Torrance creativity test. Great. Second thing, does this test have these results? Again, yes.
Okay.
Great. But in this case, they use a very limited definition of creativity. And if you look at the science about creativity, and Sawyer has written a great book on it, giving a kind of overview of all research being performed on creativity, then you see that this very limited definition of creativity is only a niche in how people look at creativity. And if you look at all the other research with other definitions, you find the opposite, that creativity augments by when after 6 years old. So that children are becoming more creative by becoming more older and becoming more educated.
Ah, of course.
Because a very important element you need to be creative is knowledge. And I
Yeah.
know a place where a lot of knowledge is being spread. It's called school.
This makes sense.
But would Ken Robinson have asked, does school foster creativity enough? That would be a whole different story.
Yeah.
Because school does give children stepstones for creativity. But if you look, for instance, Anne Bamford has done research on that. If there is not a lot being done with that knowledge in giving children the opportunity to be creative in education, then it's getting more complicated. So the real good question would have been, does school foster creativity enough? And probably the answer would have been not enough.
Okay.
But that doesn't sound as exciting as school kills creativity.
Exactly. And of course, it also it's he uses that phrase, because he wants to build an argument, of course, to where he wants to bring his viewers or his listeners. So of course,
Of
that's not
course.
a mistake. But how about the 70-20-10?
Oh, that's one that's keep popping up in my life, actually. Again, it was a myth asked by some people, can you check this? Because they seen that we were working on the learning pyramid, that's the Loch Ness monster of education. And nowadays in companies, there's an idea that if you're talking about learning, that 10% is learned by formal learning, 20% is learned by talking with others, and 70% is by actually doing it.
Yeah.
Sounds great. And again, then I have a very simple task to check. Where do the percentages come from? And that took me already a long time because a lot of the sources are dead ends. You start looking and then you say, okay, we are mentioning another source. You try to find the other source, that other source or don't exist, or is saying something totally different. So by the end, we couldn't find any source that supports this.
Okay.
So what we did was put out, because we were getting really desperate.
Mm-hmm.
So we put out a question on the internet, on social media, on please help us. If somebody has this research,
mm-hmm.
send it to us. And we received a lot of replies by trainers
mm-hmm.
who are selling this 102070 model.
Mm-hmm.
And they all said, why do you need this?
And that question alone is a little bit scary. Like, why should you not need that?
Yeah, so yeah, he said, okay. And then they said, yeah, but it's a metaphor. Okay. And they said, yeah, but can you support the idea that the informal learning is bigger and more efficient than the formal learning? That's what the claim is about. So we just asked, and quite often I receive a new complaint. No, 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 it's evidence-based. And then I always ask the same question. Show me the evidence.
Of course.
And, and until today,
mm-hmm.
I haven't received one.
Yeah, of course. Nesmith, there has been a lot of discussion in Sweden, especially when it comes to the political side of the school debate. It's the myth about class sizes not mattering.
In our book, we have three categories.
Mm-hmm.
One category is totally myth.
Mm-hmm.
One, it's complicated, and one mm-hmm. that we don't know. We don't have evidence that supports it, but we don't have evidence that debunks it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really sad category, but sometimes it is. And if we are looking to the claim about class size,
mm-hmm.
then it's a much more complicated case.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at when politicians are saying mm-hmm. that there is no evidence at all that class size matters,
mm-hmm.
then they aren't lying. But it's not the complete truth.
Of course. It's a political
claim. Yeah.
But how does that work? Like, where does that come from, that kind of claim?
Well, for instance, if you look at the OECD,
mm-hmm.
their data supports this. If you look at John Hattie, famous for his meta-analysis in the book Visible Learning, then in his book you won't see that class size doesn't matter, but that there are a lot of other things that have a bigger impact mm-hmm. than class
yeah.
size. But what's often the mistake is people look at the figures in the book by John mm-hmm. Hattie, but they don't read the text.
Nah, yeah, of course.
And in the text, he writes, often class size doesn't matter because if you are teaching in the same way, if you teach 10 pupils the same way, then if you are teaching 20 pupils mm-hmm. the same way, you'll have the same effect.
Yeah.
Well, no shit, Sherlock.
Exactly. Because you wouldn't teach 10 students the same way as you do you teach 20 students.
Well, most of the people actually do.
Really?
Yeah. That they don't alter their approach enough. And, okay, that's one thing. But most of the studies on class size, if you look at the OECD, mm-hmm. then we have correlational research. They look at class size, they look at the PISA results, and they say, well, okay, there is no big influence.
Mm-hmm.
But why is somebody inside a small class? Is it because they are living in outside the city? Is it because they are a smart group? There can be plenty of reasons why somebody is inside a small class.
Yeah, of course.
This makes research very, very difficult.
Mm.
And there are only a couple of longitudinal studies where that they looked at people in small or bigger classes and looked at the results, the evidence, on the longer term, for instance, 10 years later, 15 years later, and then it's getting more complicated.
In which way? How is it more complicated?
Because then they see there is a big effect of small class
mm-hmm.
size. And then they see that, for instance, if you look at children being put in little classes, in smaller classes, in when they are young, that later on they will be earning more money and will be more healthy.
Really? That's really impressive.
Yeah, actually, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's even a Swedish study.
Ah, cool. I don't know about that, but it kind of makes sense, but it's also surprising.
Yeah. But the same results we can see from American study. So, and then they say, okay, maybe class size is not that important when we are talking about secondary education. But if we're looking at the real young children, this could be the case. But there is a big, and now I want to defend the politicians for a second. Because our job as scientists, and even little scientists like me, is to give information to policymakers. But we aren't the policymakers. And for instance, the effect of smaller class sizes, well, the profit, you'll have to wait 20 years for it. And maybe policymakers will say, you know what, we can't wait that long. Let's do something else that is maybe more effective in a shorter time and costs less.
Let's pick a fourth and a final myth to talk about that's been a huge deal in Sweden, namely learning styles.
Yeah.
You can get all.
Oh, here we go again. Yeah.
So what is the deal with learning styles? Because they have a huge impact in a lot of, at least they had in a lot of schools all around.
Like, well, they have a big impact on educational thinking. They have no impact at all at learning.
Exactly.
And while learning styles supports a gut feeling, because everybody will think, yeah, but you know, I'm more visual learning and I'm more auditory or kinetic learning. Well, it's very simple. Everybody listening to this podcast can earn $5,000, and it's no joke. You can put a link on your website. Everybody can earn $5,000, and they have to do something very, very simple. You take a group of pupils, large enough, but if you're working in school, lucky you have your pupils at your disposal. And you take a learning style test, and you are free to pick whatever learning style test you want. Because when we were doing our research on learning styles for our book, we found over 70 different learning styles.
Wow.
Most of the people think they know a couple of styles. Yeah, you have visual, auditory, and the other one I mentioned. You have Kolb, but there are many, many more. None of them are proven, but there are many, many more. So you pick your style. I will explain to you based on visual learning and auditory learning. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
But you can pick whatever you want. You split randomly your group of pupils in two groups. Group A, group B. Group A, well, you will teach them based on their learning style. For instance, the visual learners get to see it. The auditory learners get to hear it. And group B, you do the opposite. You are teaching them based on the least interesting or least relevant learning style for that pupil. If you're a visual learner, you get to hear it. If you're an auditory learner, you get to see it.
Okay.
If you're able to let them perform the group A better than group B, you'll get $5,000.
Really? And this is you paying, or is it like...
No. Will Thalheimer has put a ransom, a reward.
And how long has this been out? At least, how long has it been offered?
Well, a couple of years, actually.
And nobody's still been able to produce.
Oh, no. A lot of people tried.
Yeah, of course.
But nobody succeeded.
That's really interesting. I'm going to put up this link. How can this become such a big deal when it's not supported by evidence?
Because, it's very easy. It's very simple. And we really love simple solutions in education. B, it's something that sounds right, because we all have our preferred ways, but a preferred way is not an optimal way. And we all are, some people are better in remembering images than sounds. For instance, I can't remember faces. I'm really
Okay.
bad at it. But again, it's more complicated than that. And maybe you can add also a link
Yeah, sure.
to the video by Daniel Willingham explaining why this reasoning is wrong.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And there are two main problems. The one problem is that differentiating based on learning styles has no effect.
Okay.
But the second thing is we don't have any solid categorization of learning styles that has been proven. So, for instance, if you look at the Kolb test, very popular in education too, you're not sure if you take the test from a pupil today, that if you take the same test 2 weeks later, that you have the same results.
Ah, so maybe then they have different learning styles, and then it doesn't really work out. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes it very
Yeah, it does.
complicated.
So, that was really interesting, and I would like to, first of all, thank you for discussing these myths, and if anyone listening wants to know more, then they should go out and buy this book, either in English or wait for it in Swedish later this year.
Yeah, and everybody is doing it. So if you have still questions or think, is this a myth? Try to catch me
Yeah,
online.
exactly. I'm going to put some links to your Twitter or whatever so people can find you. I read
Okay.
this really interesting post on your blog. It was from a few years ago about.
Yeah, the link is yeah, but it keeps popping
Yeah, it
up.
doesn't.
There is a very famous picture doing rounds on social media with young people sitting in front of the night shift, the night watch painting in Amsterdam, and all the children are looking at their cell
Yeah,
phones.
exactly. And it's like the end of the world or whatever. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wondered, is this correct? To find out other pictures from the same moment. And no, it's not correct. It's the pupils are doing an exercise about painting on an app of the museum.
I think when I read this was such a beautiful thing because I saw the picture first, and somebody just sharing, "Look at today's youth, they're so hopeless, they can't even appreciate good fine art when they're put in front of it." And then somehow your blog post appeared in my feed, and it was like, "Aha, now I get it."
Yeah, well, the end of the world maybe is near, but that wasn't the case at that moment.
Exactly. So that's a really good point. Pedro, once again, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're
I'm going to
welcome.
post all the links that you were talking about on our website, skolesverige.com, if
Great.
somebody wants to read more about it. Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to your book in
Okay.
Swedish. Bye.
Bye. Svenska skolan med Karin Berg och Jakob Mölstam.